It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This morning, we visit a mead tasting room in Fairmont.
I believe that the Mountain State is making some of the best honey left in the world, partly because we're so far from primary sources of agriculture and chemical pollutants. Here we make forest honeys instead of agricultural honeys.
Join us for a tasting in just a few minutes. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Professional baseball has played an outsized role in West Virginia. Tonight on West Virginia Public Broadcasting, a radio documentary, Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston, tells part of that story through the memories of the fans who attended the games. Senior reporter Dave Mistich sat down with Eric Douglas, the producer of the show, to learn more about what listeners can expect.
So, Eric, I want to start by discussing the style and the format of Batter Up. I understand it's made from a series of oral histories, and I think anyone that listens to it can hear that it's in a different sort of format than what other people would hear, you know, on radio in this style. I guess I'm curious if you could describe to people what that method is and why you chose to use it on this project.
I see this as more of a documentary style rather than a news style, but I really wanted to focus on the stories and frankly, even less on the storytellers, but more on the stories they had to tell. So that's why it'll do three or four stories, and then I'll introduce who they are. I really wanted people to identify with the stories they were hearing and just focus in on those messages or those memories rather than worrying about who the speaker was and what why they had their perspective.
And I guess I'm also curious about what brought you to do this kind of project. I mean, baseball is a subject that, you know, West Virginia Public Broadcasting has addressed, you know, on Inside Appalachia. So, I mean, it's also one of those, the national pastime here in America. It's sort of that omnipresent subject. But I'm rather curious for you as an individual, what was the motivation to do this?
You know, it's interesting, Dave. I've been doing oral history collection for 6-7 years now. My first one was on West Virginia war veterans, capturing their histories. And I did a similar project, not quite exactly like this, but I did a similar project with them. With this one, actually, it was funny. I grew up in the Charleston area and was well-versed, or I thought I was well-versed with the story of baseball in this region. Actually, I was talking to a younger friend of mine who made some comment about his memories of Watt Powell Park. And I was thinking to myself, he's too young to even remember Watt Powell Park. Now, he was probably 10 the last time there was a game played in Watt Powell. But it made me think, you know, there's a lot of people with lifelong histories, lifelong stories about baseball and what it meant to the family or what it meant to them personally. I didn't want to get into the stories of baseball players as much or, you know, the teams themselves, but I really wanted to focus on the personal memories, the personal things that happened at the ballpark and the way people remember them as kids going with their parents. One of the people who talks in the documentary talks about his mother, the opening season of the Charleston Charlies, his mother, and he actually went to the ball game, and she always got them box seats right behind home plate. And so it was just those personal family stories, I think, is what I really wanted to focus on.
One of the things I noticed about this project is that it's almost a who's who of the Charleston community. You hear from former Mayor Danny Jones, filmmaker and author Danny Boyd, Ron Blackstone, who of course is known as the Toast Man at Power Park. Each of these people seem to have a connection, a very really intimate connection to baseball around Charleston. Were you struck by the impact that these teams have had on very significant players in the community?
One of my favorite stories from the whole documentary is Danny Jones talking about an event that happened when he's 8 or 10 years old, I believe. He got lost at the ballpark. They took him down into the dugout, and he sat and watched the post-game fireworks with one of the players. The part that didn't make it into the documentary, just because it was too long of a story, But Danny, later when he had his radio show, he ended up calling this player who was still alive. I believe he's still alive today. Wayne Terwilliger is the player's name. But he ended up calling him and thanking him on the air 40 years later, 50 years later, just because of the impact it had had on him as a young boy. So I was definitely struck by the memories they had and the people who came in.
And one final question for you. Do you yourself have any similar connections to baseball around town? Did you grow up going to the ballpark like many of these other folks that you hear from in this documentary?
It's funny. I'm old enough that I know I went to Charlie's games, but I don't have any strong memories of them. Where I truly became connected with baseball at Watt Powell Park was in the early 90s. I was just after I had graduated from college, and me and my buddies would go to the ballpark and hang out before we'd go out and do other things. But, you know, it was an excuse to go hang out and sit outside and enjoy the ballpark and enjoy the game and have an adult beverage or two and just enjoy summer nights out at the ballpark.
Well, all right, Eric, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Dave Mistich talking to Eric Douglas about his baseball radio documentary, Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston. It airs this evening at 8 p.m. and will be available online thereafter. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:50. Rain and thunderstorms today. Some storms with heavy rain, gusty wind, and hail. Highs in the 70s. Chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, chance of rain and thunderstorms early, becoming partly sunny with highs in the 70s and 80s. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by A New Chapter Bookstore in Lewisburg, with books, coffee, gifts, and more. Details at anewchapterbookswv.com. Mead is often associated with Vikings and medieval feasts. In the 1960s, it made a brief resurgence thanks to Renaissance festivals. But in the last couple of years, there's been a new revival in mead. According to the American Mead Makers Association, it's the fastest growing alcoholic beverage in the country. Brittany Patterson spent some time with some West Virginia mead makers and learned how the Mountain State's unique charm is influencing their craft.
Ruth Ann Smith and Tom Maltby started out making honey wine, or mead, for friends and family. 5 years ago, they opened their tasting room and custom-made micro factory, located inside an old neighborhood bar in Fairmont, West Virginia. They specialize in a very old style of mead, which they describe as European peasant style. Tom, who sports a long gray-streaked beard and brown leather fedora with feathers, explains.
In some ways, similar to a dry wine, in some ways similar to a refreshing beer, they're light. They're all crisp. It's a refreshing beverage rather than a syrupy sweet beverage.
At its core, mead is simply water, honey, and yeast mixed together and left to ferment. Fruit, spices, rose petals, and more can be added, making it a versatile drink. Mountain Dragon Masery makes 9 varieties. On a recent afternoon, Patty Menjivar and her family have stopped into the tasting room while on vacation.
And it's wine made from honey. And this, you know, I start like a think about it, you know, a curiosity.
Ruth Ann pours a blush-colored liquid into a small plastic cup. This variety of mead is called a rotamel. It's made with wild roses harvested at their home along the Monongahela River and fermented with wildflower honey harvested from their bees.
And so the roses that we use, it's known as the tea rose, and that's one of the more fragrant of the roses.
Patty takes a sip and nods approvingly.
It's really good. Yes.
In the decades since Ruth Ann and Tom began experimenting with mead, the industry has taken off. The rise in popularity of craft beer and spirits has also lifted up mead, says Vicky Rowe, head of the trade group the American Mead Makers Association. She says in 2000, there were less than 100 commercial meaderies nationwide. Today, the group estimates a new meadery opens on average every 3 days.
As a matter of fact, most of the new meaderies being opened at this point in time are being opened by those in the 25 to 40 age group. So it's, you know, it's very popular with, you know, with the younger people, millennial, Gen X, Y, and Z.
Ruthann and Tom say they've seen growth both in the demand for their mead as well as the literacy of their customers. Ruthann says they enjoy introducing curious patrons both to mead and its history.
It's really just in the last couple years, we're really feeling that burst of everyone really, wow, I've never had mead. I've heard of mead. It exists right here, and that's been really neat to bring that to the local community and just West Virginia in general.
Their marketing reflects this old world theme. Their blue glass bottles of mead are adorned with a dragon and red-haired maiden logo. There's a large black and orange dragon kite hanging near the bar. Because mead is at its core made from honey, each batch will imbue the characteristics of where it is made. Appalachia's unique geography plays an especially important role. At their farmhouse just a few miles away, Tom shows me the bees that make the honey used in Mountain Dragon's mead.
You can see I used to have 30. That whole horseshoe was hives.
Each 60-gallon batch of mead requires 10 gallons of honey. As their mead operation has grown, Tom and Ruthann moved most of their hives to the care of another beekeeper in the state. They have 48 hives there and 4 at the farmhouse. Tom says by using locally sourced honey, West Virginia's essence is captured in every batch of mead.
I believe that the Mountain State is making some of the best honey left in the world, partly because we're so far from primary sources of agriculture and chemical pollutants. Here we make forest honeys instead of agricultural honeys.
Hawk Knob Hard Cider and Mead owner and founder Josh Bennett agrees. He says the taste of a honey, and subsequently one's mead, is closely tied to where it was harvested and the local flowers that grow there.
So what kind of trees you have in your forest, what kind of pollinators are out there, and what the bees happen to be working with. Appalachia has a lot to offer in that way, and the diversity of, you know, of the biosphere that we have here.
Standing in Hawk Knob's tap room, located just outside downtown Lewisburg in Greenbrier County, Josh describes one of their meads.
So this is our barrel-aged reserve sizer. So what we've done here is we've taken our fresh-pressed apple cider, where we've taken about 8 varieties of heritage apple, and we blend that juice together. Then we add local honey to that, and then we ferment it more or less like wine.
This mead is what's called a sack mead, which means it's dry and has a higher alcohol by volume content, or ABV. It was aged in bourbon barrels for 2.5 years and packs a punch at 20% ABV. I take a sip.
So definitely, definitely dry. I definitely get the fruity notes,
yeah.
And it has like the honey gives it sort of a buttery mouthfeel.
Later, sitting on the back porch at Hawk Knob, Josh says he can see why mead's popularity is growing.
You can have something herbal, something fruity, something sweet, something dry. You can hop it up like a beer, or you can, age it like wine. And there's just a lot of versatility, and you can create a lot of different types of beverages within the realm of mead.
Vicky Rowe with the American Mead Makers Association agrees. She's hopeful that adventurous craft alcoholic beverage drinkers can find a mead that appeals to them.
I can just about guarantee they'll find something they like in mead as long as they're willing to be, you know, to be adventurous and not be afraid to try new things.
She says honey has its own terroir, a term wine drinkers use to describe the flavors that reflect where ingredients are grown. Because honey's taste is reflective of where it comes from, so too is craft mead. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
To hear more stories about businesses that are using local ingredients to make alcoholic beverages, check out the latest Inside Appalachia episode. Find it at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.